Our next speaker is Charles Leonard, and Charles comes to us from Baton Rouge. He's a specialist in DHS data sheets and safety data, and he's been working for 15 years in the industry, producing mostly in mines, chemicals, and industrial operations. And he's especially, and this topic came up when Catherine Lewis said, what do you know about the new rule that migrates MSDS sheets to safety data sheets? And I told her, what? And she said, yeah, you have to do it by, you know, January of 15. When? So we had to get on the horn and look around, and we've actually came across Charles from the association. It's the Society for Chemical Hazard Communications, which I had never run across before, but it's people like Charles who do chemical hazard communications across all industries. So he's got expertise that would help us not just on this topic, but on all hazard communications relative to our industrial activity. So I'm pleased to announce Charles Leonard, who will speak about MSDS to SDS conversions. Charles?
Okay, thanks so much.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, by way of background, I was born in New Orleans. I studied chemistry and microbiology at LSU. I worked 30 years in the synthetic rubber industry, laboratories, quality standards, product development, process control. I got involved in regulatory stuff when OSHA was promulgating standards for asbestos, noise, butadiene, acrylonitrile, all this in the 70s and 80s. Became a certified industrial hygienist at that point. So if any of you guys are making a product out of reclaimed rubber, you might want to talk. My recent focus has been mostly industrial hygiene, process chemistry, environmental lab assessments, and of course safety data sheets. So why does this not work?
And that's when you pre-test it, too.
Okay, like we did this morning.
Yeah.
Okay, most of this presentation was prepared through OSHA Alliance in concert with the Society for Chemical Hazard Communication and OSHA. So I've taken their presentation and I've supplemented it for you guys. Through the Alliance program, OSHA works with groups committed to worker safety and health, and basically to facilitate their mission. SCHC is a broad-based organization that promotes hazard communication for chemicals. I'm coming to you today as part of their outreach program and a speaker's bureau. Okay, so what I would like to do is give you a broad overview of the new standard, how it's similar, how it's different, and then go into some specific examples and some things that may be of particular concern to you and the ways that this might affect you. Okay, so OSHA aligned the hazard communication standard with GHS to improve definitions of hazards, specific criteria for labels, harmonized format for safety data sheets, and to facilitate international trade. There were a number of different symbols and criteria used that created confusion in the workplace. There were different criteria. This one is acute toxicity. Flammability is maybe another example that's used. Here we have a history. The first hazard communication standard was done in 1983 by OSHA. In 1987, OSHA expanded this to all industries. They established requirements, but not a format. So we didn't have a format for the safety data sheets until ANSI came along with the standard format. 1991, the European Union brought us pictograms, risk and safety phrases. In 2003, the first version of GHS was published. In 2006, OSHA did an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, public hearings in 2010, and March 26, 2012, the final rule was published. GHS is based on existing systems, OSHA, Consumer Product Safety Commission, EPA, so Canadian systems, European systems, and it was largely driven by the United Nations transportation of dangerous goods. People who worked on it were pretty much these, taking different parts. Notable changes using a specification approach rather than a performance-oriented approach. we're talking about hazard classifications rather than a hazard determination. And we have requirements for identifiers, pictograms, signal words, hazard statements, precautionary statements, and producer information. GHS changed the name to safety data sheets, defined a 16-section format. And when OSHA published the rule, they put things in different sections, which we'll get to. Okay, so how this is supposed to work is producers, importers prepare the safety data sheets. They go into the workplace where employers do training. There are labels on containers. Training for workers.
this is a industry focus rather than a consumer products focus. Things that are changed, and well, this is organizational final rule. So the OSHA requirement, some sections are essentially the same, and there are modifications of others to match GHS. There are appendices which go into some of the details. They are prescriptive. It's basically a cookbook approach, as GHS is. So the OSHA rule, section by section, section A is purpose. In 1994, we evaluated standards, and now we classify standards. The provisions are the same. And there was some wording done for alignment. Section B, scope and applications, is essentially the same. Same content. Section C on definitions, there was some rearranging. And yeah, I mentioned flammable liquids, there were some definition changes. Section D talks about classification. Each hazard has a detailed criteria, and we're going to talk an example of that in a bit. There are mixture rules to assist in the classification of hazard classes. Okay, so we've gone from performance oriented to a cookbook. Physical and health hazards are a hazard class. For instance, flammable liquid, acute toxicity, carcinogenicity are hazard classes. Hazard classes are subdivided into hazard categories based on severity of the hazard. So what we're doing is we're determining not only the hazard but the severity of the effect. So manufacturers are still responsible for determining the hazards of the chemicals they produce. And we're using data to a hazard classification. For instance, health hazards, we have hazard classes. We have different categories depending on the severity of the effect. Mixtures, it was a straightforward 0.1 for carcinogens, 0.1% for other effects. Now there's a tiered approach, although the 1%, 0.1 still applies in a lot of cases. So we're going to use test data on the mixture as a whole. We're going to use dilutions to extrapolate from other data, if possible, and similar mixtures, similar types of compounds, we can transfer data that way. Estimate hazards based on known information. And cephalonic health hazards. So there are specific rules for each classification. Okay, so you rely on information provided by your suppliers unless you have a reason that that's not right.
Charlie, I can't hear you. Can you move the mic up?
Sure. Okay, physical hazards follows the same approach. We have hazard classes. You have categories. Yeah, no, I don't want to go too much into OSHA has made a few additions that are not found in GHS, parafluoric gases, simple asphyxiants, and combustible dust. Probably you're not so interested in the first two, so I'm not going to cover them, but I will go to combustible dust. Combustible dust became an issue for EPA, for OSHA, when in 2008, you may remember that there was an Imperial sugar plant outside of Savannah, Georgia, that had an explosion and fire, killed 14 people, injured another 20. That was one of several combustible dust explosions in the 2002 to in the next few years that caught OSHA's attention. So OSHA specifically included this in their hazard communication standard. They've created a national emphasis program for combustible dust, reference NFPA standards, and these are the warnings. It also applies to materials that are shipped in solid forms that may create a combustible dust when processed. I'm not sure that really applies to you either. Okay, so combustible dust is different from flammability. Combustible dust is basically, there's a test that's based on the amount of dust that passes a 40 mesh screen, that's put into a container with a spark. Depending on the energy, it can be classified with a deflagration index. Okay, so sugar, KST is 138, lignite 151, peat 157, wood flour, wood dust is 205. So the OSHA standard gives this table. If as the types of explosions that may result. So if you have a dusty process, you may want to be concerned about this. You may want to be aware of this. Section E is on a written hazard communication program. It's essentially unchanged, except that you need to update safety data sheets and update training. Labels are prescribed. The same sort of a cookbook approach. We'll have an identifier, signal words, hazard statements, pictograms, precautionary statements, responsible party. So that's new from some of the stuff we had before. Okay, so labels are a specification approach. Details on labeling can be found in Appendix C. So these are the pictograms and hazards. OSHA does not have jurisdiction over environmental, although environmental hazards are in the GHS standard, and they're implemented in other areas of the world. Okay, so we have health hazards, flammability, exclamation mark for irritants, skin sensitizers. Ozone layer is not mandatory. Gas pressure, corrosion, and explosive hazards. Some interpretation letters have talked about red versus black borders. OSHA is requiring red borders. and they're not allowing an empty border, as some people wanted to do in the case that there wasn't a hazard. Labels updated within 3 months, getting no significant information. And the filing rules require six months after information is available to be labeled accordingly. So basically, you have 6 months to update labels on the materials going out. Here's a label example with the items identified in Appendix C. Some people have their own label systems. NFPA, HMIS supplement that as rating systems versus classification, as we're doing with GHS. And again, this needs to be kept current. Section G talks about safety data sheets. We now have a mandated 16 sections, orders of information, and the contents is prescribed, the headings are prescribed. Section 12 and 15 are outside of OSHA's jurisdiction. Requirements to provide safety data sheets are essentially unchanged from before. Regulations require that we provide safety data sheets with the initial shipment and with the first shipment after safety data sheets updated. Or we can send them ahead of time. Manufacturer importers should also provide distributors or employers with safety data sheet upon request. I think some of y'all probably write a letter that says that you don't need a safety data sheet for this product, as I guess a response to that. Okay, so we now have a 16-section safety data sheet. These are the these are the sections. Sections 2 and 3 are swapped from the ANSI standard. Otherwise, it pretty much follows the ANSI standard that you're probably accustomed to. Appendix D talks about minimum requirements, including ACGI HTLDs and IARC and NTP classifications on carcinogenic state. Section H talks about training. There's a training deadline of December 2013. So, and that's pretty straightforward. So we're going to train on label elements, how they can use the new information, and the format. Okay. Trade secrets are essentially unchanged. Shall provide information to health professionals. That may be new, but pretty much the definition of trade secrets and how it's applied is not changed. Okay, so effective dates, December 2013 for training, June 1st, 2015 for having safety data sheets available, and this is implementation part. affected OSHA standards that are impacted by this, for example. There are chemical-specific, health-specific, safety-specific standards that talk about defining hazards and labels. OSHA went through all these, did updates. I'm not going to cover that because I don't know that that really impacts you. The health examples, asbestos, lead, vinyl chloride, butadiene. Safety examples being flammable liquids, welding, PSM, has water. For the health standards, for example, yeah, regulated area signs for a lot of the chemical standards have to be updated. An example of that, for instance, is asbestos. So the labels and signs are updated, basically reworded to reflect GHS. So employers need to do initial training, minimal training on the format, update the safety data sheets, and review current hazard communications programs and update that as needed. Manufacturers have to now classify and produce labeled safety data sheets and do training. OSHA has a fairly extensive outreach program. There's a lot of stuff on their website. It's a great resource. This talks about, this gives a side-by-side comparison of new and old, and they have really a lot of information on the transition and the new standard. This is training information that might be good and might be useful in your employees. These are two OSHA web pages that might be useful to people trying to implement a system. The UN website also has information. You can get the, you can download the Purple Book, as it's called. It's 530 pages. Obviously, I'm not about to cover all that here. OSHA also has letters of interpretation, provide guidance on specific sections, specific questions. I have some examples of that in a bit. And there's a Hazard Communication Directive that talks about how OSHA field inspectors are supposed to enforce hazard communications. And they have this for most sections. It's not just HAZCOM. So the Hazard Communication Directive provides an outline to compliance officers what to review, how to cite. Again, this is not just for HAZCOM. They have this for most of the OSHA standards. And it's good for clarifications. Okay, so I'd like to go through a hypothetical formulation to give you an example of how this is actually implemented. So my friend Ellen has a special blend that has peat moss, bark and wood chips, perlite, potassium carbonate, and some water. So the first thing I'm wondering that's, you know, that's not in here is, could this dry out create a dust or explosion hazard? So step by step, I'm going to start with first component, peat moss. What I find is KST is 157, so that's a weak explosion hazard. So that suggests that that should be a combustible dust or have that classification. I don't find any other hazards in the data. OSHA and ACGIS earth limits are generally applicable. So I'm going to take this and I'm going to classify it as combustible dust. So far, so good. For wood dust, I picked Western Red Cedar, which happens to be a sensitizer. We find OSHA nuisance dust limits. We have a KST value that gives a 205 foam explosion hazard. So ACGIH classifies it as a sensitizer. And A4, NTB classified as NTP classified as a known human carcinogen. IR classified as a group 1 carcinogenic. Most of this is related to the woodworking industry. People are doing carpentry and building furniture, things like that. Maybe that doesn't apply to you. Okay, so after going through the data, we're going to classify it as carcinogen, sensitizer, and combustible dust. Okay, so perlite, we have respirable dust limits. We have an oral LD50 for mice that's more than 5,000, so that's not classified as an acute toxicity. I find that perlite is listed among the 1994 hazardous chemicals. It's identified there as a high skin respiratory irritant, but I don't find data to support that classification. Maybe you have data in the industry that supports that, where you know that this is that this is correct. I couldn't find the data, so I'm going to say not classified. Potassium carbonate's our fertilizer component. We said that was 5%. We find LD50 data. We find it's irritating to skin and eyes. So we're going to classify it as acute oral category 3 and a skin and eye irritant. But we look at the rules and we find that it's not classified as less than 10. So we only have 5%. So I'm not going to classify on that basis. Okay. And then water is not classified. So
trying to transition.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the other file. There we go. Okay, so what I've done is come up with a safety data sheet. It's got the manufacturer's information. It has the classifications. It has the labels, the pictograms, hazard statements, precautionary statements that are derived from the hazard statements. This one came from being a sensitizer. If I picked a different species of wood that wasn't a sensitizer, that would go away. That could also go away because there's a rule that says that if you have this one, you don't need this one. So there's, you know, it's basically a cookbook approach how to put it together. Section 3 talks about ingredients. Those are the ingredients with the CAS numbers that we saw before. Section 4 talks about first aid measures. Most of these are driven from the hazard classifications. Firefighting,
accidental release measures or general good practices. Generally, I would get this from the producer. What do you consider is appropriate for spills of your product? In this case, maybe it's not a hazard. For exposure controls, we have different limits that we have for motion, ACGIH. Engineering controls. Various forms of personal protection that that might be appropriate. Section on physical and chemical properties, section on stability and reactivity, toxicology we found from the literature, and those were the basis for acute toxicity classifications. I didn't find aquatic or so forth ecological data. I have a section on regulatory information, and section 16 would include NFPA classifications and that sort of thing. Final thoughts. OSHA doesn't have jurisdiction outside the workplace. If you're selling consumer products, that's probably the domain of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. We said that hazardous chemicals in the workplace are covered and require a safety data sheet also on request. There's a section in the standard that talks about wood products. Not required for wood or wood products, including lumber, which will not be processed, where the chemical or chemical manufacturer or importer can establish that the only hazard they present to employees is the potential for flammability or combustibility. And maybe some of your products fall under that. But it's incumbent on you to be able to establish that makes sense. Not required for consumer products, we talked about that. This is more dealing, this is maybe applicable here, but this is more, I suppose, cleaning products that might be used in a workplace that in the same way that you might use them at home. It's a letter of interpretation, March 3rd, 1989. It says that safety data sheets must be provided to commercial customers. They're not required to provide to retail distributors that have informed him that they do not sell a product to commercial customers or open the sealed container for other use at their own workplace. This may apply to packaged products sold to other stores and distributors, that sort of thing. Okay, be aware that states have programs that are have their own OSHA programs that are at least as effective as federal OSHA. There's 25 states. Anything else?
Yes, you have as an example.
Yeah.
I mix. You face the flammability, the combustibility on a 5% moisture. Now, potty mixes are 40 or 50% moisture. Does that then override the need for the combustible declaration?
The combustible dust test
requires that you dry it to 5% or less moisture.
Right.
Okay. So I guess to answer your question, no. It doesn't matter that it's 40 or 50% moisture. If you dry it to less than 5%, you determine the KST values, and that becomes the KST values for that dust. Okay.
Okay, but then on your last slide, you said if you have a chemical suppression agent, which would be water, wouldn't that then negate the need for it?
Where did I say that?
Well, I misread that or misunderstood, but there's something about its exemptive if you can show that it's not going to be. That one there.
Well, yeah, if you can do that, that's your out.
Yeah. So at 50% moisture.
And
it's not going to be combustible.
Right.
So therefore.
Or it's moisture in this case.
So it could be interpreted that way.
I think you could.
Okay.
If you have data to support that.
Yeah, I don't think I can get heat loss to ignite it with moisture.
What OSHA will do is they'll come in, they'll take a sample, they'll send it to their lab in Salt Lake City. The Salt Lake City will dry it to less than 5% and run the combustible dust test on it.
Okay. Then, okay, I think I understand that.
Okay.
Would that be the case? Would that make everything fun?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
what she says. Well, you know, I guess the problem I have is that you have wood dust listed as a carcinogen. It's listed in the California Proposition 65 list. So I'm not sure how you get around the carcinogen thing, except maybe to demonstrate that it's not dusty.
What were the definitions of gust? Was it 40 mesh pipes? Is that correct? Size and yeah. Moisture content.
Yeah, there's a whole list of things that's in the OSHA standard. It's actually in the OSHA combustible dust literature. There's a bunch of tests that they run on it. The KST value is one of those.
But why would they dry it if it's not dried in? And it might be good to know what are you referring to specifically, the language, so that people can look at that. Is there a section that discusses how this test is done?
It's in the combustible dust section of that OSHA has, which I don't believe I want that. Certainly.
On the same subject, how do you, if you have extra water in your material, how do you show that that's suppressive? If they have to dry the test to do the KST test at 5%, can they do the test at 50%? And the difference would be the suppression that you have, or how do you do that?
Well, the test prescribes that you dry it. Okay, so that's applicable to a workplace. Okay, if you have a manufacturing facility and it's dusty, and you're subject to an explosion hazard, you know, that's how you determine that.
Yeah, but also you were saying that if you had a suppression agent, and if it happened to be water, you said you could make that claim if you had the data.
I didn't say suppression agent.
What this says is if you can establish that the only hazard they pose to employees is the potential for flammability and combustibility, then
you cannot define it as explosive, as a combustible dust. I went through a lot of this pretty quick. But I didn't want to wanted to get to the end and entertain questions. So far, so good. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Charles.
Okay.
For most just wood products like mulch, untreated, etc., didn't require an MSDS.
What's in it? Can I classify
wood.
It?
Wood. Ground wood.
The hazards that I find for wood dust are carcinogenicity and combustible dust.
But you have to take each component and look it up in IROC and all the different sources
if you
and see.
Classify it.
Okay.
The example, I guess, came from one that I did for paper mill.
Okay.
A paper mill may have a whole lot more wood dust than some of the people here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I think quantifying the amount of dust that you have may be the key point to not having to declare some of those hazards.
And you have to run a respiration test to do that, or?
Well, if you can demonstrate that your product's not dusty, then you don't have the respiration dust issue.
In the workplace,
right.
Right. Good. Thank you.
Okay.
I think we have another break at this point, and then we're going to have Bill talk about, Dr. Bill Fontenot will be discussing
mulch blending
or product blending procedures and the work that he's been doing on that relative to certification and some issues that have been raised in the industry. So we'll see you back here at 11 o'clock.
Yes.